here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 20th of February. I'm Konstantin Pradanovic. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca. In lieu of regular programming today, we bring you stories from our friends and partners from across Canada.
Today on Wings, the second and final part of a speech delivered in California by Dr. Vandana Shiva, a very influential scientist, policy analyst, and activist from India. In last week's episode, Dr. Shiva deconstructed the rhetoric of genetically modified agriculture. This week, she speaks more to solutions.
There is at this point a huge parting of ways, two paths for the human future. One is no future at all, and the other a future in peace with all of the earth and all her species. We'll have to be more brilliant than we've ever been, more resilient than we've ever been, more courageous than we've ever been.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The single biggest threat to our health is what is called food but is not food. Because you can cheat on a supermarket shelf, but you can't cheat the cells of the body. An artificial molecule will be recognized and show up in disease. Poisons will show up in disease. I think one of the big debates that's going to grow is the fact that most of the GMO crops cultivated are Roundup ready, which means the use of glyphosate. And the combination of glyphosate and GMOs is triggering so much harm to the planet as well as our health. A lot of it is not allowed to come out. But the science is growing. How much can you hide? The science is growing about glyphosate not being a safe chemical. There's a movement of moms across America. There's also a counter movement of moms for Monsanto, by the way, to deal with moms across America. Moms across America collected their own breast milk samples, and some of the women had 10,000% more than the permissible limit. Food is the place where we really become part of the earth family. Food and air, the oxygen we breathe that's given by the trees, and food as the currency of the web of life. As an ancient text, an Upanishad says, everything is food, everything is something else's food. Food is the web of life. And when you realize that everything is food and everything is something else's food, we wouldn't do pyramids with man at the top, because there'd be microorganisms above us. You know, they have a feast when we go. In India, we cremate, but where you bury. We are not the last link in the food chain. Who said that? We're just a link in the food chain. And the food web of life is where we can, on the one hand, be the most destructive species on the planet, or start serving the earth and respecting the rights of nature. We are on a road to extinction if we carry on the path that we've been walking. We might as well be writing our RIPs right now. There is at this point a huge parting of ways, two paths for the human future. One is no future at all, and the other a future in peace with all of the earth and all her species. There is a survival struggle, but not in the Darwinian style. The survival struggle right now is about corporate rule trying to survive at any cost. And issues like the ruling of Citizen United is one example, where corporate influence on democracy is translated into free speech. As was commented when the decision came out, even though corporations are artificial entities with greater access to capital, infinite longevity, and no interest in or connection to humanity, I would add no connection to nature either, we now guarantee them the right of free speech. Freedom of speech was intended as a way for human beings to guarantee their ability to speak out against largely systemic and structural repression. A corporation has the same guarantee. And if the corporation has that guarantee, then people don't. And we've seen two very clear expressions of the perversion of the idea of corporate personhood. It is a perversion. One is the fact that after having used money to destroy democracy in the area of labeling of GMO foods in California, in Washington, in spite of that, Vermont got its GMO labeling law through. So what is the response? The response is the corporations get together and say, if you know what you're eating and you have the choice to make whether you'll eat organic or GMO, then you are taking away our free speech. That's what it means, suing Vermont on the grounds of free speech, on an issue of labeling, which is a right to know, basically saying citizens' freedom have to be extinguished in order to establish corporate freedom to destroy democracy, destroy the planet, and destroy our health. And that clearly cannot be accepted. The other place where this corporate personhood is being attempted to be institutionalized is in this new generation of free trade treaties. Now, you know, they put in place World Trade Organization as the ultimate free trade treaty, and they called it the Constitution of the World. And then we organize in Seattle, we organize in Bangalore, we organize in Cancun, and WTO has been in intensive care. It's no more a very efficient vehicle because everyone knows what that treaty is. So they're trying the same trick through the transatlantic and transpacific partnerships on trade. And when we organized for Seattle and shut WTO down, The Economist was writing cover stories against us. The same Economist now is writing on the fact that these new trade treaties have these sections which are called investor-state dispute mechanisms, which basically means corporations can sue governments that pass laws to protect their citizens, whether they be environmental laws or health laws or workers' rights laws. And I was very interested to see that even the Economist has to say this corporate personhood is going too far. This is what the Economist says. If you wanted to convince the public that international trade agreements are a way to let multinational companies get rich at the expense of ordinary people, this is what you would do. Give foreign firms a special right to apply to a secretive tribunal of highly paid corporate lawyers for compensation whenever a government passes a law to, say, discourage smoking, protect the environment, or prevent a nuclear catastrophe. Yet that's exactly what has happened in these texts that are being prepared. Now, there are two recent examples of how this was used. After the Fukushima disaster, the green movement in Germany was able to mobilize. The Greens won elections in some regions, and they were able to call for a ban on nuclear power. But soon after the decision to shut down nuclear power plants, Germany was sued by a Swedish company called Vattenfall, which demanded compensation of $4.7 billion, saying, we have lost our market, and you compensate us. When Bolivia stopped the water privatization, Bechtel sued Bolivia. Indigenous people of Ecuador won a very important case, and I realize there's been recent public tribunals on the issue of a Chevron leak out here. Well, Chevron was responsible for destroying large parts of the Amazon. And indigenous people filed a case, and they won. But Chevron is now suing the government of Ecuador. Because the people of Ecuador won against Chevron. Chevron is suing the government of Ecuador for compensation for the losses. Our call in Seattle was, our world is not for sale. And I think between the time of Seattle and today, the evolution in movements has been, at that point, what we said was, our world is not for sale. Now we're saying we are part of the earth. We will respect the rights of Mother Earth. Therefore, we will have all human rights which are derived from nature and her ability to give us the food and water and the clean air. That human rights and nature's rights now require that all violations of the rights of Mother Earth and the rights of people be treated as ecological and human rights violations and crimes. We're not going to go there just by saying it. We'll have to be more brilliant than we've ever been, more resilient than we've ever been, more courageous than we've ever been. And we have that capacity. I've been saving seeds and dealing with laws that take away farmers' rights. We've been dealing with creating alternatives, particularly in areas where seed monopolies, like in the case of BT Cotton, have pushed a huge number of Indian farmers to suicide. Government statistics, it's 291,000. These are not my figures. I'm not cooking up figures. These are official statistics. And official statistics are an underestimate. They're an underestimate because if you've leased land and you're not a landowner, that doesn't count as a farmer's suicide. It's put into the box of ordinary suicide. So there's an undercounting. One would say there's a much higher number. But the seed issue has taken a whole new level. In 2004, we had an attempt to pass a seed law that would make local seed saving illegal. I traveled the country. Wherever I knew people, we held rallies, we collected signatures, and we collected 100,000 signatures, which I gave to our Prime Minister with our pledge, which said, when the British tried to control the salt through a salt monopoly and a salt law, Gandhi went to the beach, picked up the salt, said, nature gives it for free. We need it for our survival. We will continue to make salt. We will not obey your law. And the salt law could never be implemented. Gandhi was put into jail, but the law could never be implemented. We continue to make salt. And we told our Prime Minister, we've received these seeds from nature and our ancestors. We owe it to future generations to hand this over in full integrity, diversity, and freedom. We will not obey any law that prevents us from performing this ecological duty to the earth and to future generations. We managed to stop that law. But it's interesting that in the same year, 2004, your country got a seed law, and nobody knows about it. Now they're using the 2004 law to go after citizens who are saving a few seeds in seed libraries. First they go after citizens, then they'll go after the seed businesses, then they'll go after wherever there's freedom. It's time for a satyagraha in the United States. And for those who don't know what a satyagraha means, satya means truth, agraha means force, the force of truth. This was Gandhi's word for not cooperating with unjust law. He first put it to use against apartheid in 1906. Said, we will not be divided by race. We are one humanity. And we will not obey your laws on racial separation. Apartheid means separation. Ecological apartheid means separation in our minds from the earth and all she gives us. Gandhi then used the same satyagraha for salt, used it against the forced cultivation of indigo. We need a global satyagraha, a global satyagraha for the rights of nature. We need a global satyagraha that, as always, as every satyagraha does, arises from the deepest love, both of our relationships with nature and our relationships with community, as well as a deep respect for who we really are, because what we are is Earth citizens. What we are is part of one common humanity. And the same process of globalization that is creating the rule of fictitious beings who aren't beings is also dividing people. All of what's going on in the Middle East, the conversion of what began as an Arab Spring into an Arab nightmare, is linked to these issues. It's linked to the fact that the movement in Egypt began with bread. The movement in Syria began on drought. Farmers were suffering a very severe drought, so they marched to the capital. They were thrown into jail. Others came to support their relatives and friends. Before you know it, they were being called rebels. Before you know it, there was a war. Before you know it, an anti-Assad rebellion was suddenly ISIS. And now we don't know anymore who's an enemy and why they're there and why they're doing what they're doing. But we do know this, as Gandhi said, the earth has enough for everyone's needs, but not for a few people's greed. We have a very beautiful prayer that talks about peace. In a deep sense, it talks about peace with the earth, talks about peace with the skies, it talks about peace with the waters, about peace with the plants, peace with space, and says, may that peace be with you. And I read peace with the waters as the ability of rivers to flow free and unpolluted. I see the peace with the plants as plants being able to evolve into the future without being genetically engineered and contaminated with toxins and without being patented. And peace with the sky is quite clearly the call to say, stop messing up the atmosphere. Now, we have solutions in our hands, because while industrial farming is the single biggest contributor to climate change, ecological agriculture is the single biggest solution that we have to deal with emissions. And while some of us go to climate treaties and some of us go to our capitals, most of us can make the change where we are. And the beauty of multiple crises being connected is multiple solutions are also connected. It's the same actions that we need to take. That is, working in harmony with the earth. When we respect nature's rights, nature produces more food with us. All we have to be is co-creators and co-producers. When we respect nature's rights, we conserve biodiversity, and that biodiversity works for us. The pollinators, now they're counting, $169 billion annually is the contribution to our food economy, and yet we are killing them. You allow them to thrive, we have more food. The more organic matter we have more water. If California's soils had been organically farmed, the drought of this year would not be as severe as it is. So while the crisis is deep and extinction stares us in the face, the earth is inviting us to change our path, to create an earth democracy, to shape an ecological age with humility with respect to the earth, but brilliance in all our hearts and all our minds, because I do believe brilliance also lies in the heart. The rights of Mother Earth, the rights of the humanity are not separable. And the most radical power we can generate against this abusive corporate rule and its fictions of corporate personhood is celebrate our own being and celebrate all the beings that give us life. We couldn't have a more exciting moment to be alive in. Thank you.
On Wings, you're listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva, speaking in Berkeley, California, at an event organized by KPFA Community Radio in October 2014. Now, excerpts from questions and answers. Some questions are rephrased by the editor, Kelly Ramirez Watson.
Most of the movements in southern countries, which were called underdeveloped, developing, have been based on the rights of nature and humans as a subsystem of this planet and nature. The first movement I got involved in 40 years ago was SHPCO, where women came out and hugged trees. And it was based on the rights of the forest and rights of mother goddesses of the forest, but it was also based on what the forest provided and the rights of the women to those products. But it wasn't only about human rights, it was also about the rights of nature. For southern cultures, which have had a continuity in their ecological existence as ecological societies, rights of nature has been the ground for all human rights work. Every anti-dam movements have been about the rights of the river to be able to flow free. From industrialized cultures, the rights of nature movement is now emerging. Through the solidarity with countries like Ecuador, which actually put this in its constitution and unfortunately is not adhering to the constitution so respectfully, or the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth, made after the Copenhagen negotiations were subverted by, sadly, President Obama flying out from his Peace Prize, going and telling India, China, Brazil, South Africa, why obey these international treaties? Let's just have a consensus amongst ourselves and get rid of legally binding treaties. And that's when Evo Morales took the initiative, the drafting of the Rights of Mother Earth, which is a very powerful document. I think there are two other places where this is happening, which is at the level of communities realizing that as human communities, we are stronger when we ally ourselves with the rights of nature. Not in an instrumental way, but at a level of higher consciousness. Because when you raise your consciousness to be part of a bigger web of life, you yourself expand in your capacity. You expand in your courage. And every movement that has been inspired by the rights of nature is a stronger movement. It's a stronger movement that shifts the ground from begging for favors, from structures of power, to declaring solidarity and protection with all beings. And I know here in this country around fracking, you have so many initiatives. In Italy, local communities love the word territory. They talk about territory as the place where you belong, the unique ecosystem, its plants, soil. And they are declaring in more and more municipal councils sovereignty for their territory, which means no poisons, no pesticides, no GMOs.
Dr. Shiva was asked what she would tell the audience to do.
Well, I never tell anyone else what to do. I ask myself what I should be doing. And I do invite people to both see the amazing threats to our biodiversity, our climate, our food systems, but also the amazing opportunities that are in our hands, if only we would wake up to them. Not underestimating the small, because it's millions of small that'll make the big movement of our times. Not one big movement where all of us march with one slogan. There will be no one slogan beyond the fact of the rights of Mother Earth. And it's not going to be our slogan. It's going to be her slogan. All we have to do is follow the instructions and work in compassion and solidarity in a deep, deep way. Realizing none of us are in a situation where we can say, oh, it's their problem, this won't hit me. Everyone will be affected. Everyone is being affected. The privileged can insulate themselves for a little time longer, but it's just for a little time longer. I think the two big things everyone can do is see ourselves as part of an interconnected world. That alone, that shift in consciousness, is a very powerful step. We've always thought doing is physical action, but doing is also mental shifts. It's a doing within. And that doing leads to a lot of external possibilities. The second is we need to give up the primacy to our silos. It's been secure. I'll protect fish. But you know, the fish is linked to how much runoff there is from the farms. So you can't just say, I love fish. You got to say, I don't like violence to animals. I'm not going to support chemical farming. So the connections keep growing. And as we see these connections, we develop respect for each other's work. And we develop respect for each other's space. This body is 500 trillion cells. 500 trillion cells can cooperate. Why can't some of us?
Dr. Shiva was asked if technology itself was evil, or could it be used beneficially?
I would not talk about technology in terms of evil or good. Technology is a tool, and a tool gets assessed for its usefulness. So I think some technologies are absolutely useless, GMOs being one candidate. We don't need them. They don't do any work for us. They don't control pests. They don't control weeds. They don't increase nutrition. They don't increase food. So as a tool, we know that we are better off with biodiversity, with intelligence of human beings, to breed crops, to grow ecological food, to increase productivity through co-creation with other species. That's how we control pests, control weeds. That's how we increase nutrition. And some technologies are intrinsically hazardous. The big debate on GMOs is, you know, if this was in a public system, it would be fine. But a BT toxin is a BT toxin. With Monsanto, it has a patent associated with it. But even without that patent from a public university, that toxin is a toxin that harms the butterflies and bees, that survives in the blood of women and in the embryos. That toxicity doesn't go away according to the political context of which it is a part. So that's why we need technology assessment. We have created a utopia of stupidity around technology use. We need to use other values to judge. Is a technology delivering or not delivering? And the three big values are, what does it do to nature and ecosystems? What does it do to our health? And what does it do to our freedom? Those are the tests of democracy, safety, and ecological sustainability that every technology must be passed through. And on GMOs, that's what we keep saying. Let it pass the test. It's continued to fail, but let it pass the test. And what the industry is afraid of is the test.
She was also asked what farmers and consumers in the United States and the rest of the world can learn from India's experience in fighting GMO producers such as Monsanto and Syngenta.
The first is to realize that it's happening here too. Farmers might not be committing suicide on that scale, but farmers are committing suicide in this country. I read a book called Harvest of Rage soon after I'd written The Violence of the Green Revolution. And I realized that in India, farmers first took to guns and violence and then moved to suicide when the military oppression came. In this country, they first committed suicide. So the crisis is here. In terms of the seed issue, I do feel that these first few beginnings of serving notice to seed libraries should be of citizen concern, not just to the few people who were trying to create that seed library. I think that law of 2004 needs to be studied. We've written a law of the seed, group of scientists, group of lawyers, to basically understand from the seed, how does seed really evolve? And therefore, any law that's based on rights of nature should follow that law. Seed does not evolve into a monoculture. Even within the same variety, it has a little diversity. Even within the same family, children will be different. So diversity is the nature of evolutionary freedom. The second quality of seed that evolves in freedom and societies and cultures that evolve in freedom is resilience. But what's being imposed through these laws that are making seed saving illegal, and in fact, the statement has been made that saving seeds that has been used over thousands of years, is agri-terrorism. How can planting an ancient heirloom to matter be agri-terrorism? You need to have the safety of GMO crops. So this new vocabulary that's being created around uniformity, terrorism, etc., needs to be contained now. And it can only be contained, as I said, through the Satyagraha.
You've been listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva, renowned scientist, feminist, and activist from India, speaking in Berkeley, California, at an event organized by KPFA Community Radio in October 2014. For more information on the movements Dr. Shiva works with, visit the website www.navdanya.org. Navdanya is spelled NavDanya. That's navdanya.org. Dr. Shiva's speech was edited for Wings by Kelia Ramirez Watson. This is the second of two parts. If you've missed any Wings program, email wings@wings.org or check our news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm the Wings series producer, Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service. Today on Wings, Dr. Andrea O'Reilly, the mother of motherhood studies.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Andrea O'Reilly is an associate professor of women's studies at York University in Canada. The scholarly publishing house she started, Demeter Press, puts out regular calls for articles about aspects of mothering. In July 2011, when she spoke to Wings, Demeter had just published her massive anthology, The 21st Century Motherhood Movement, Mothers Speak Out on Why We Need to Change the World and How to Do It. I'm Frieda Worden, and here's my interview with Dr. Andrea O'Reilly.
Can we talk about some of the organizations that are applying, mothering theory?
Or? Yes. I mean, in the book, The 21st Century Motherhood Movement, Mothers Speak Out on Why We Need to Change the World and How to Do It, and basically making the point that we need a feminism that is mother-centered. And I coined the term, for better or for worse, mattress-centric feminism. Not ever to imply to replace, you know, mainstream feminism in its various configurations. But I do believe that women are oppressed in patriarchal cultures. They're oppressed as women, but they're also oppressed in ways quite unique to them being a mother. And so sort of identify what that specific oppression looks like if you're a mother. But as importantly, to also think about how mothering can be a place of power for mothers. And I think in our culture, and Adrienne Rich talks about this at length in her book, Of Woman Born, the irony, or more appropriately, the tragedy, is that the very thing, for lack of a better word, that gave women historically power was their motherhood identity. But that very thing now has been misused and used against them. So it's about reclaiming the maternal power that has been taken from us, but taking it back in such a way that empowers us and the work we must do as mothers, right?
Well, yeah, it is very strange, actually, that sort of the judo that was performed on feminism mm-hmm. was that women got the right to work, but also we lost because wages fell. Mm-hmm. Now two parents have to work
yes.
To make as much as proportionally as one parent used mm-hmm. to be able to make. So we haven't made any gains there, but we've lost the ability to spend, of either parent, to spend
yes.
as much time with the children.
Right. And again, this is not feminism fault at all, but I do think we live in a culture, and any mother or any thinking person would agree, that completely, you know, devalues mother work. They don't see it as work. Well, it's not work. It's not pay. We live in a culture, of course, that value is determined by monetary measures. And because mothers are not paid for the work they do, they're not seen as working. And I think that's gotten worse over the years. And we've becoming increasingly in a neoliberal world, in a material world, that worth is even being more determined by your paycheck than I would say 20, 30, 40 years ago. And to compound that, as you said, now households require two incomes. And the thing that troubles me is that I do think for some women, there have been huge gains since the rise of feminism. I mean, largely privileged, you know, middle class, white, able-bodied women, that if you can live as unencumbered and disembodied and talk and walk like the boys, then you can really benefit from patriarchy. If yes, of course, not completely. We still have violence against women. We still have battering, of course. But I think when you become a mother, motherhood is encumbered and it's embodied. And in our culture, only, you know, those who do not have that can compete as so-called equals with men. And the reality is that women still do the majority of childcare, home care, domestic labor, and I also call it community care. They're the ones who, you know, keep the neighborhoods running. I also call it, like, emotional care. They're the ones who make sure, you know, an aunt Sally falls down and breaks her leg, that flowers are delivered to the hospital, and somebody makes soup for when she comes home. So women, you know, have a first, second, third, and arguably fourth shift. And that hasn't changed. So that, for me, that's people always say that feminism, you know, feminism has stalled, and why? And a lot of people have said it's because of motherhood, that motherhood is the unfinished business of feminism. I think it's partially true, but I think the unfinished business of feminism is men, right? That's where we need to make social change. You know, we have to redefine mothering as a social good, as something that has to, it's required, and all have to do it. So now women today, yes, they have to behave as unencumbered, individualistic citizens in the workforce, and then come home and do all the encumbered work of maternal care, and men get off the hook, you know?
Well, I do think that in the last decade or two that the younger fathers seem to be assuming more of the parenting obligations and the pleasures of parenting.
I think so, and I always joke to my students, in my days of despair, I need to remember that. But I still think what's happening, and I don't think I'm alone in this, I draw really from Sarah Ruddick's work here, I think that women, though, are still doing the psychological work of mothering, the emotional work, what Sarah Ruddick calls maternal thinking. They're the ones remembering, planning, organizing, anticipating, you know. So I always say if the, you know, the woman has to remind her partner to get the bag of milk on the way home, delegation does not equality make. And I think a lot of households, men are doing a lot of FaceTime. They're at the park with their child. But the woman is still keeping the household in her head, who has to go to the doctor's appointments, you know, or, you know, their daughter, 12, is not eating. Oh, do we need to be worried? Is she suffering from anorexia? I mean, kind of keeping all that going on, that men, and I've done a fair bit of research on this, and as has Andrew Doucette from here in Ottawa, that men really don't do that emotional, intellectual work of mothering. They put in the FaceTime, but I think that's what most women say is exhausting about mothering, particularly when it's combined with paid work, because it's completely unbounded. You know, it's a job that never ends, mothering. So you're lying in work, you know, bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, worried about your child or planning an event. And that type of stuff, I think, is what's catching up and causing a lot of burnout with women. It's not so much the work, though that's hard, but that kind of intellectual, you know, holding the household in your head, that can't be downloaded. And I don't think men are sharing equally in that sort of maternal thinking. And that part, until there's truly that shared intellectual labor of raising children, I think we're going to still be stuck.
Well, how do you think that that might be brought about?
I think by doing it. I mean, I really believe that mothering, there's nothing natural about mothering. I don't think there's anything inherent. I was a young mother, unplanned, 22. Somebody asked me a baby, and I said, you got to be kidding me. I had never held a baby. I didn't know anything about mothering, and I thought it was a joke. I said, you're letting me take this 8-pound baby home. I became a good mother by doing it, and I didn't have my mother near me. She lived in another city. I learned the hard way. I wouldn't advise that either, completely on my own, isolated. But I learned, and you see this often with men who have full custody or men who are widowed. They become completely competent doing that stuff I'm talking about, that maternal labor, intellectual labor, because they have to. And I always say to my students, I say, my advice is have men involved from day one and have them involved in such a way where the woman is completely absent. Like I say to my students, you need to go away for a week, maybe ideally two, and you don't do anything. You don't prepare the meals. You don't iron and lay the clothes out. You don't organize the kids' schedules. You walk out. And you know what? By the second or third day, and he can't call his mother either, though. That's also the part of it. He can't, you know, he has to do it. And, you know, I know many men who are completely involved, equal parents, because they're doing that real work, not just the fun stuff on Saturday afternoon, the FaceTime. So I really think that men are as competent parents as women, but they just don't have to, because, you know, women are telling them how to do it and, you know, where to do it. And I think if you just step back, men will figure it out like every woman on the earth has figured it out.
Right. Now, what about the larger society and the way all the resources are being pulled out from under most families, so that mothering becomes sacrificial, you might say? Mm-hmm. Are you going to eat, or are your child going to eat? You know, these things.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, I write about this and talk about this in my teaching, and Demeter Press will be publishing a book on this. I believe that neoliberalism, the rise of neoliberalism, has probably been the death knell for mothers, because there's been just a complete removal of any type of, you know, societal, governmental support, complete emphasis on individualism and, you know, self-reliance, and everything's been downloaded to the family. It's now your own fault and your own responsibility. And I do think that's a huge problem. And I think we're going to realize it even more in retrospect. I think we're going to look back and go, oh gosh, you know, we can see it happening in the 80s and 90s. I do believe we're in a crisis situation with families because they are completely unsupported. And absolutely, I mean, mothers need support to raise children well. And families need support to raise children well. And it just puzzles me and frustrates me that they don't get that. It, you know, they're always say we love children and children are our future and they're going to pay our pensions and all this empty rhetoric. But they don't support families to raise the children that they supposedly, you know.
What kind of support would government, ideally, or perhaps in a normal society, offer?
Yes, well, I think we have certainly models. For example, we can look at Quebec. I mean, their child care program has been hugely successful. Yes, I've heard criticisms of it and justified ones, but quite on the micro level. I read in the Toronto Star just last week or 2 weeks ago a large report, and I want to see the whole report, this was just a summary of it, that it has paid for itself. It, because of the increased wages of those working women who are now back in the paid labor force, who are paying income tax, and according to their books, it is a self-sustaining program now. So absolutely childcare, you know, good funded, non-profit childcare. Also, definitely, as I said earlier, though I'm a bit ambivalent about maternity leaves, I think we have to have extended parental leaves. And certainly public and social policy that recognizes care work as a social good. So whether that be sick leave for family, I don't even like the term sick leave, I like sort of family leave or whatever you want to call it, personal days, that we are not just workers, we're human beings. And I think everybody should have a personal day or two a month. And if that means taking your car in to be fixed or taking your pet to the vet or taking your child to the dentist, you know, we are human beings and we have to run our lives. And we have to understand that. And I think in the past we were able to do it because we had wives doing it. Men had wives to pick up their dry cleaning or, you know, do whatever. These wives are now working in the paid labor force. So all this work of running households is just now hanging in limbo, but it still needs to be done. You know, so I do think we have to understand that family work, childcare is not a private individual thing. It's part of the larger social fabric. So even just a change in perspective, then I hope would change policy.
Well, let's talk about the effect of motherhood studies as something that may eventually change policy.
Mm-hmm.
How did motherhood studies get started, and what is it like now?
Yes, I mean, we started using, I mean, I actually coined, I think, in 2006, the term motherhood studies. And maybe it should have been mothering studies or maternal studies, but that name seems to have stuck, motherhood studies. Basically, I really see motherhood studies as very parallel to women's studies. There was a recognition of an absence. So with women's studies in the 60s and 70s, women were not being included in your history course or your sociology course or what have you. And women recognized that to make that happen, they had to, you know, create a discipline of their own. Certainly when I began my work in motherhood in the 90s, early 90s, I actually did a quite involved analysis of curriculum here in Canada, a little bit in the States, and motherhood was not on women's studies curriculum. I mean, it was quite alarming, and what was even more alarming, they didn't even realize it wasn't there.
I think that probably relates to the absence of motherhood from the entire academy.
Exactly. Yes, you're absolutely right. I'm doing a research project now, a Shirk-funded one. I've just finished my interviews. I interviewed 70 mother academics across North America, and I had my children, you know, 20 to 25 years ago, and things are not better. The academy is so hostile to mothers. It's more hostile than any other profession. Academics have fewer children than architects, doctors, lawyers. It's quite alarming, actually. And so there's been a lot of thinking about why that's so. But yeah, motherhood was completely invisible. So the people who are creating new knowledge, researchers, teachers, were not mothers. So understandably, they didn't include it on their curriculum. So an average intro to women's studies course would have violence and education and sexuality and work, all important topics, but you wouldn't find motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't see the M word mentioned in a women's studies class. Now that has changed somewhat, not as much as I'd like to, but I do believe it's become an independent field. And sort of like women's studies has its own you know, body of knowledge, traditions like must-read theorists or canon of the, you know, the thoughts, and they have debates and they have different perspectives, just like women's studies does. So I think it's been around maybe 10 or 15 years now. Then we can see it as an autonomous, interdisciplinary discipline, very similar to women's studies.
Who would you say are the must-read theorists in motherhood studies?
Oh, the must-reads. I would definitely say Adrienne Rich, who I believe is the mother of motherhood studies, who published A Woman Born in 76. Sarah Ruddock, most definitely, who unfortunately passed away last March. Her concept of maternal thinking. Earlier, African-American, for example, Patricia Hill Collins would be a must-read. More contemporary, Fiona Green, who's here at the conference here. She's a Canadian scholar of mine. I do think it's a growing field, so I actually published a book 3 years ago called Maternal Theories, The Essential Readings. And it basically has 50 chapters. And I'd say to somebody, if you want to know what motherhood studies is, this is the book to dip from. So Mary O'Brien, for example, is in it as a Canadian contributor. And it just basically goes from 1976 to contemporary. Ariel Gore, for example, just stuff on Hip Mama is in it. And a fair number of queer and lesbian, Catherine Arnip, for example, here in Canada. So I try to make it as much Canadian and American, and to cover, you know, 30 years of maternal theory from different perspectives.
Is motherhood studies actually making inroads into universities? Are they making spaces for motherhood studies? Is it mostly in the women's studies departments, or how is it manifesting in academies?
I think there are sort of these kind of interesting independent courses. We're publishing in July, this month, I guess, the third edition of a booklet we do called Teaching Motherhood. And it's a collection of syllabi on motherhood, or reproduction more generally. And we actually have courses that are from anthropology, I don't want to say zoology, but anthropology to women's studies. And yes, it's in all the disciplines, you know, psychology, anthropology, history, health, obviously social work, poli-sci. So they're kind of these clustering of courses in our syllabi. I think we have 50, so not a lot, but that's still not bad. I mean, these are just sending out on email. If you teach a course, send it to us. So they seem to be housed in different places. I don't think they're more in women's studies than not. In fact, I think they're maybe still less in women's studies. Most of motherhood studies courses are coming from other disciplines. So they'll have a motherhood studies course in anthropology. Right, I actually gave a talk at January of this year. I went down to a university in the States, and it was sort of an anthropology course that was a special topic one, you know, fourth year seminar, and the special topic for that year was motherhood. So they seem to come under the special topics, you know, in literature or something. You know, they'll have special topics, mothering literature. So I think it's still interdisciplinary. I don't really think it's based yet in any discipline, and I would say less so in women's studies. Women's studies has a very ambivalent relationship with motherhood, and I think it's getting better, but it's still fraught with tension.
I think that the women's studies often feels that they're just clinging to legitimacy by their toenails,
yes.
And that the patriarchy is breathing down their neck.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think, understandably, there is nervousness because motherhood, and what I talked about in my talk today, you know, I think the distinction between motherhood, which Rich theorized as oppressive, patriarchal, understandably, feminists wanted no part of that. But I think what happened is, I use the expression, threw the baby out with the bathwater. It's not mothering that's the problem. It's how we're expected and told and regulated to mother. But I get that. In the early 70s, motherhood was oppressive, as it was represented and lived by most women. So there's a real nervousness. And the other thing, too, that I think there's such nervousness around what we call essentialism in women's studies. We want to see gender as constructed. We want to ignore the body. And very nervous about any claims that women are indifferent, because that's suicide, right, for women's studies scholars. That's what's been used against women forever. And so I think there's a real dancing around motherhood because it's seen as always oppressive, which I don't believe it is, and it's seen as essentialist, which I don't think it is. But I see how women's studies professors get very nervous how that could so quickly be turned against and used against them. That there's all, and I may add that majority of women's studies professors aren't mothers. I mean, that's just the way it is. Now, there are some, but there are fewer women's studies professors that are mothers than other disciplines, in my experience of interviewing. I mean, you'll find more mothers in history or in sociology than you'll find in women's studies. I don't know why that is. I mean, I think part of it is feminism. But it's interesting. And I'm not saying women's studies, certainly my experience, my department has not been hostile to me at all. They've been hugely supportive. But I've heard other women's studies scholars have had less than reception to the work they do. They keep it in the closet. They don't talk about their motherhood research.
Well, in your talk, you were talking about some of the criticisms of arguments about motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
You said emotionalism was one, essentialism was one.
Yes.
You just talked about. You want to just mention what the other ones were?
Well, yeah, I think emotionalism is an important one, too. I mean, it ties in with the other ones because motherhood activists have often used emotive strategies. And the criticism was coming from feminists and others, but early 2000, because the motherhood movement's only been around for in an organized way, 5-6 years, so it's very, very new. So we can't really talk about it because it's still forming. But early criticism of the motherhood movement was that it relied on emotion for the strategies. And they saw that as irrational and, unpredictable, and they called it, politics of grief. It's a club nobody wants to belong to, i.e., mothers against gang violence who've lost their children to gang violence. And that's what I probably take the most offense to, because all activism is motivated by the personal and the emotional. Of course it is. That's why you become an activist, right? Because something in your life has angered you or your child or your partner. And I just find it so interesting that only motherhood organizations have been brought to task for their emotionalism and they're too personal. And yet the civil rights movement, environmental movement, peace movement, they've all been founded on feelings and thought, as much as thoughts. So this critique of emotionalism has really been quite devastating to the motherhood movement. They want to be prepared rational and orderly and composed. And I don't think so. I think the organizations in my book have demonstrated that a lot of this emotionalism, yes, is felt, but it's also very deployed strategically. They use it strategically to get attention, to get an audience, to get sympathy, and then they got them where they want them, and then they become these, the more militant activists. The other criticism is embodiment, that maternal activists have really often positioned their protests or strategies through the body. So the example I gave in my talk, for example, the Argentinian mothers, when they were protesting the dictatorship, they would wear placards, life-size, of their children's on their bodies, right? Marking their memory, like their children could not be forgotten. The mothers acting up are quite flamboyant, performative group, and when they march, they come out on stilts, and they dress up, and they, very colorful, very performative. Likewise, Code Pink, whenever they're the peace activist group, mother, they only wear pink, and they come out with pink boas, and they deliberately, inscribe their body so that they can't be ignored, right? So they're very visible. And if you're coming out on stilts in a march, somebody's going to pay attention to you, right? You're very visible. So a lot of these organizations, they don't deny the body. In fact, the activism is expressed in and through the body, both through marches and, as I said, sort of these very embodied forms of protest.
And your own solution to that was somehow to combine everything?
Yes. Whatever works, works. There's a multitude of strategies to draw from other activists. And so if you have to play a good mother, if that's what you have to do, you do it. I mean, you don't believe it, but you do it to get the media interview or to get the appointment with the politician that you wish to speak to. So I say that women often play normative motherhood. Oh, I'm a mother, please listen, I just love my child. Well, yes, that's all true. But they're doing it, I think, very strategically to get the audience, to get the attention, to get the media attention in particular. Like the mothers of Argentina said, nobody's going to run a mother down with a tank. They're not going to. And so people say, well, that's co-opting. And, well, if it works, it works. And these women they were very political. They might have acted like good, pious mothers, but they didn't stop there. They were extremely radical and militant and public. So I do think that mothers are really redefining activism. It's both private and public. It's both rational and irrational. It's sort of both, intellectual and embodied. And I think that they're really defining the meaning of activism. And I think they're making it a lot more joyful, too. I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say fun, because a lot of these are very sad organizations that have, lost children to gun violence or police brutality. But they're doing it I think often very much like third wave feminism, in a very performative, very public way that is more, I don't know, I can almost say colorful, that they're really claiming space. They're not, you know, they're in a way that's very, I keep saying performative, just that they're...
And maybe you could say expressive.
Expressive, yes.
Because you can express yourself, that's fun.
Yes, exactly, yes. It's expressive. And they can do it all these kind of really crazy, playful, ironic ways. And I think it's neat. Like, the example I always use, and I know there's a lot of controversy around Slut Walk, but I think Slut Walk has been one who's embraced that kind of performative, in-your-face, expressive, we're going to play with concepts. And I think the motherhood movement is quite similar to the Slut Walk. They're kind of using tropes and then reinventing the word, right? Saying, okay, yeah, I'm so-called a good housewife. Well, just watch me, right? I think deconstructive strategies.
I have to say that I think that that was what was so fun about the women's liberation movement in the 70s, too, that maybe this has always been the strength of the women's movement.
Yeah. Every feminist I know has a great sense of humor. We're all fun. We play hard. We work hard. But there's this really negative view of feminists of being angry and, well, we are angry. But there's this real negative, and I don't know where that comes from. Because every feminist organization rally event I've been to, it's been a blast, right? So I don't know where the stereotype has come. So I say to my students, what are you talking about? Have you ever been to any of these events? Well, no. And I said, well, how do you know then that they're these strict, you know, serious... I mean, yes, of course, some of them are when we're dealing with very tragic things. But I think even in then, there's a sense of camaraderie and joy among the women. One woman who's in the organization, she started an organization, Mothers Against Trafficking in Humans, and lost her child to human trafficking. And obviously, you can imagine how tearful her talk would be. But I've never met a woman who has such a sense of humor and such joy and such passion that you're listening to her and you're crying, but you're simultaneously laughing. That her ability to take tragedy and try to use it in a transformative way. And I think that's what a lot of these motherhood organizations do.
Well, I think this is the most radical thing that I've seen in a very long time, the motherhood movement. I think it gets right to the core of the anti-human trends. And how they must be stopped.
Right, and I was interviewed earlier today, and I mentioned in my talk as well, what frustrates me probably more than anything is the view that motherhood is apolitical, that when you become a mother, somehow you've sold out, gone over, you're not a political person anymore. And I think, where did that come from? Motherhood is the most political place it can be, both in the way we raise our children. I'm very proud to say I have three feminist children, all in their 20s, I think my best accomplishment. You know, I'm very proud to say that both women's studies major. My son's off to start his PhD at McGill in human trafficking. So I'm like, wow, I can say that I've done well. I mean, I don't take all the credit by any means, but I think we can really raise a different generation of children. But also, even through our mothering, we can find power as our women. Because so many mothers have told me it's when they became a mother that they felt for the first time in charge, angry, you know, I'm not taking this anymore. And I don't know what it is, like, I do know, but I think it's complex, that motherhood really can, really radicalizes women and politicizes women, or at least it can. And I think it's really a place where we can, you know, make change. I'm not saying the others aren't as good, but I do think it's untapped. There's globally over 80% of women become mothers. And we don't have 80% of feminists, okay, unfortunately, in the world. So if we can use motherhood, make all mothers feminists, then we can change the world.
So if anybody can, you can.
Oh,
Andrea O'Reilly, thank you so much.
All right, thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay.
Andrea O'Reilly is the founder of MRCY, the Motherhood Initiative for Research and Community Involvement. She publishes Motherhood Scholarship through Demeter Press. To hear this program again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughan, whose scholarship posits mothering as the paradigm of the gift economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Werden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.